abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, December 18th, 2013. Today we're talking separating school and state with our friend Sheldon Richmond. Sheldon will be joining us in just a few minutes. And in the meantime, a couple things I want to tell you guys about. Some of you know that I've been working myself into an early grave by preparing courses for the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, ronpaulhomeschool.com. It's not that I don't enjoy doing it, it's just the sheer amount of stuff I'm doing. So I'll remind you that it's a K through 12 curriculum. I'm doing courses for 9th through 12th, and it's 180 video lessons per course because it's 36 weeks of material, 5 videos per week. 180 videos per course, 20 to 25 minutes each. Some of them are a little shorter, some of them are a little longer, but that's an enormous amount of work. There's just no getting around that. So right now I'm doing Western Civilization 1 from antiquity up through about the year 1492, and that is covering just a staggering amount of material. And the way we did it was so that we could open the curriculum up as early as possible, get as many students in as possible. We opened it up with the courses not quite ready, but we were all at least 8 weeks ahead of the students. So I'm 10 or 12 weeks ahead of the students in terms of how many videos I've prepared and how many they will have watched by now. So I should be finishing up Western Civ 1 completely within the next couple of months, but there are plenty of people already taking it. They're way behind me, thankfully, but that'll be all done. And right now I am starting up my second course. This is only half a course. I'm doing the second half of the government course. So this will be open and ready to go in January 2014. So this will be 90 lessons because it's half a course. And I'm just so thrilled with the stuff that I get to cover in this. So the way the course works is we start off by talking about the theory behind government and a free society. What's the relationship between government and freedom? So I start off with a whole week on the history of natural rights theories. What are natural rights? What rights do we really have, and how do we prove that we have them? And how in the history of Western civilization have various thinkers tried to prove that we have them? So I go through all that starting from the High Middle Ages all the way down to the present. So we talk about a lot of thinkers you'd never heard of. We talk about the late scholastics. We talk about John Locke. Talk about Robert Nozick, Murray Rothbard, Hans Hermann Hoppe with his argumentation ethics. All of that stuff is there. Then the next section of the course is, here are the rationales government gives for intervening in our lives. Because the typical government course is, here's why we need the government. They don't consider that there might be another point of view. So I give the government point of view. Here's why they say they need to intervene. Public goods, so-called, helping the poor, inequality is a problem, monopoly, discrimination, whatever, and all these other sorts of public goods that are a subset of my public goods lesson would be science and all these other things that they need to fund, supposedly. But I don't just go and give the government rationale. I then give the other side. Well, wait a minute. Here's how we could actually live without government involvement and still solve this problem. And then I go through, I have a section of the course now, some problems with government action. So I talk about the socialist calculation problem, and then I go through a whole bunch of issues in which government intervenes supposedly for our own good. Government helps to provide us money and farm programs and health care and protect the environment and labor unions and et cetera, et cetera. We go through all those. We give both sides. Here's what they say they need to do, but here's the reality. So I give both. So in other words, there's at least two different ways of thinking about each issue, whereas the usual version of things is that when you go into government schools, you're getting a wonderful array of different ways of thinking. But if you're homeschooled, you're just getting one point of view. We all know the truth is exactly the opposite, of course, right? That in the government schools, you get the government point of view. But in this curriculum, you get both sides. Now, obviously, you can tell which side I favor, but at least you get both sides. Then we go on to a kind of comparative systems unit of the course, where we look at Republican constitutionalism, we look at monarchy, we look at fascism, communism, social democracy like Sweden, etc. Then we have a section on the modern state itself and the presuppositions behind the modern state. We talk about decentralization as a movement against the modern state. We ask the question, is it possible for political bodies to be too large? Nobody ever asked that question. No government course, no media outlet asked that question. Then we have a section of the course called Unresolved Problems. Is political representation really meaningful? What does it mean to say your congressman represents you? What does that really mean? It's actually a lot more problematic than you think. What about the idea of the rule of law? Well, at least we live under the rule of law. Is that so? Again, that's much murkier and more problematic than people think. Are voters informed? Good question. So these sorts of things fall under our unresolved problems section of the course. Then finally, I have a section of the course called The Sweeping Critique, where we look at the works of people like Robert Lefebvre and Murray Rothbard, who reject absolutely everything that government does. Say that, no, the free market, if it is what we believe it is, the free market can provide everything we need, and we do not need government parasites to provide these goods for us. So that perspective is also considered in the course. And then we wrap up. So I think that's a lot of fun. That's going to be available. You can check that out. It'll be available by January at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And people have asked, will I be able to take Woods courses without having to sign up for the whole homeschool curriculum? Yes. In 2014, I will have a site where you can get my courses just a la carte, and I'll have announcements about that at tomwoods.com, on this program. If you subscribe to my e-letter, you'll be the first to know about this. You can subscribe to that at tomwoods.com. or at tomwoodsradio.com. All right, let's turn now to Sheldon Richman. Sheldon Richman is vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, FFF.org, and is editor of their monthly journal, Future of Freedom. For 15 years, he was editor of The Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education. His books include Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax, Tethered Citizens, Time to Repeal the Welfare State, with a foreword by Ron Paul, and the book we're talking about today, Separating School and State, How to Liberate America's Families. Sheldon Richman, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, I wanted to dig out, I have a copy of Separating School and State, this book of yours from 1994, and I wanted to dig this out and talk about it, because this whole subject, I think, is one of these issues that for libertarians, it's kind of tricky. Like, you know, everybody's against NSA spying. You know, that's a sexy issue that everybody loves to talk about because we're all against it. But when it comes down to something like this, I think this is an issue where a lot of libertarians want to turn and run. They don't want to tell their friends they're against all tax-funded education. So I wanted to bring you on and sort of, maybe as devil's advocate, I could throw some arguments at you that are common and see how you, somebody who's written a book on this, would parry them. Ready?
Sure.
Okay. All right, well, let's first, before we get into the obvious one, I think the most obvious one will be the poor won't get educated. So let's save that for a little bit later. Okay. I guess I would first start off by asking, why do you think, I mean, we all agree that there are problems with the government-run schools and the kids aren't learning what they should be learning, but look, that's because they've been deprived of funds and we don't have the right priorities and we favor basketball players over scholars, and if only we could change this, then we could get our act together. Why would you think the solution would be root and branch getting rid of the whole system?
Well, the idea that they haven't spent enough money is laughable because they've been spending amazing amounts of money year after year for 20 or so years. They've been increasing the amount of spending. I don't have those numbers right at hand, but and they haven't shown any results. There's no improvement. In fact, we just had results released from an international test in math just last week, I think, of fifth graders or 15-year-olds. I forget exactly which one. And it showed, in our, again, once again, the U.S., you know, falling behind. So it doesn't compete very well. Money doesn't seem to be making any change. The other thing is the worst districts in the world, I mean, certainly in the country, have the highest per capita spending. If you look at Detroit or Chicago, inner city schools, Washington, D.C., they have they're spending thousands of dollars, $10,000 or more per student, and they have the worst results than even in other public school districts, government school districts, that spend less per capita. So there's no correlation between the amount of money spent and the performance of the children. So that is not the problem.
Well, what would, in your libertarian paradise, I'm sorry, I'm trying to be like the average guy who's objecting
sure.
here. You know, in your utopia, where there wouldn't be any taxes collected and public services would be suffering everywhere, the worst suffering would be in the educational sector, because how can you expect some, you know, working mom to be able to afford school tuition? I mean, say what you will about government and its inefficiencies, it gets those kids in the classroom and it gets them learning how to read and to be able to get out there in the economy and prosper. And you want to take that away.
Well, a couple of things about that. A lot of those poor parents are themselves products of government schools. And I think that's one reason why they're poor. Government produces many obstacles to individual self advancement economically. And one of those, the biggest obstacles, are its schools. If you look at the inner city schools, I mean, they're just sabotaging generation after generation. If you set out to do to ruin generations of kids, you could not design a better system than the one we have. So that's one reason alone that parents today don't seem to have enough money to educate their kids. But there's a lot of other ways to look at this. I mean, back in the 80s, Marva Collins was a teacher, I guess a former public school teacher in Chicago, who got sick of the schools and set up her own school in using a church, spare room in a church. And she had some kids from some of the worst schools who, you know, could hardly read, and had them reading Shakespeare within a very short time. This was publicized on 60 Minutes, and she wrote a book. She was quite celebrated for a while. She was not spending very much per capita, and so therefore, I'm sure the parents weren't. The other thing is we have the work of James Tooley to draw on, which is very, very important. James Tooley has spent, I don't know how many years, the last 10 years or more, traveling the world, going to some of the poorest places, like in Asia and Africa. And he finds in the cities of these countries, he finds for-profit private schools for poor people. Now, you know, normally he'll go into one of these towns and say, "Does anybody know of a private school for poor people?" And they laugh at him and they say, "Of course, there's not going to be any private schools for poor people. They wouldn't be able to afford it." And in every case, he finds at least one school, and usually more than one, where the teacher is usually from that community, who cares very much about the kids, who works very closely with the parents, and they have, you know, sliding scale of tuition, and sometimes people are even just trading produce, the stuff that they're growing. And these kids are getting a decent education. They outperform the kids in the public schools. So this is a bogus problem that somehow, you know, people are not going to be able to afford education. They're only judging that by the inflated prices or inflated costs that the government school system has, but we shouldn't be surprised that government system has inflated costs.
Well, I guess I would also say to the person who makes this complaint, try to imagine yourself in a situation in which there is no government funding of elementary and secondary level education. Don't you think you personally would be more likely to make a donation or contribute to the endowment of your own elementary school, your own junior high, your own high school, that where you feel like you have a special connection from your own experience? Like, wouldn't you kick in? The reason you don't kick in now is because you don't have to, but don't you feel like there are enough nice people in the country, given that there are enough of you who are complaining about what life would be like under libertarianism? Don't you think you guys together could probably make a difference in people's lives? I mean, they don't ever stop and think, maybe I could be part of the solution, instead of sitting around trying to figure out who else could do it.
No, that's a very good point. And then a bigger way to look at that is the fact that there have always been, going back into the, you know, well into the 19th century, there have been private foundations gave money to help kids get an education. People care about education. And lots of people, when they amass some fortunes, like to endow schools or endow foundations, which then give scholarships. It's happening today as well, but you're right. It would be much more widespread if people just had more of their own money, if they were able to keep their money. And if they didn't, they couldn't fall back on the, well, you know, the old excuse that, well, the government's taking care of this, so there's nothing for me to do.
Now, another side of this coin, though, might be, maybe somebody might say, what if I concede to you that, yes, the market may well be able to provide education even for people who aren't that well off financially, but you libertarians are also against compulsory attendance laws. So even if we establish schools that these kids could, parents could afford, you won't force the parents to send the kids to these schools. So once again, it shows how antisocial and head in the clouds you libertarians are.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know what to say about someone who thinks it takes force to get parents to send their kids to school. I mean, parents love their kids for the most part. Poor parents are no different from other parents. One proof of that is when a government sets up a voucher program, often like a pilot program, and this is not meant to be an endorsement of vouchers. I oppose vouchers for reasons you might want to get into, but just to take it as a case, they may, in a pilot program, the government authority may say, we have 300 slots. Okay, well, we have 300 vouchers to offer to parents, and 3,000 people line up to get them. So what does that tell you? It tells you that parents care about their kids. Parents know their kids are getting a rotten education in the government schools, particularly in the inner cities. And they, when they get a chance to do something about it, they grab it in great, great numbers. And so, this idea that we need compulsory attendance, I think it betrays a lack of confidence in people. The other problem with compulsory attendance on the part of the government is the government's going to have to define all the terms. In other words, if you have to send your kid to school, it gets to define what a school is. And that, but that way they can crush private initiative by defining something as not being a school. See, what's missing from the government system, and there's no way a government bureaucracy could ever put it into the system, is entrepreneurship, something I know you know a great deal about. We need entrepreneurship in education. And in order to have that, we need complete freedom on both the demand side and the supply side so that people can offer new ideas, they can try things, they can engage in trial and error, which is always a path to success, without a bureaucracy having the right to say yes or no, or the power to say yes or no to any given idea. That's what we are lacking, and government will never be able to bring that to its system.
Let's go back to the subject of vouchers that you mentioned, because I guess we should address this, because you often hear in policy wonk circles that the correct approach is so-called school choice. We'll make sure that everybody gets some amount that may be somewhere in the ballpark of the per capita spending on education, and just hand it to the parent, and then they get to spend it at at government designated schools, and then this elicits the best from these schools because now they have to compete with each other. What's wrong with that model? It sounds like a free market in education. What's wrong with it?
Well, yeah, and I think that the people that most of the people that push it and people that helped devise it, the Milton Friedman, maybe the major person, I believe they were they had the best of motives, and I think they meant extremely well by that. But I think they simply underrated how much power that still gives the government. If the government is going to be directing the money, via the parents' wishes to a particular school, it's going to inevitably want to attach strings to that, because the money, first of all, will always be perceived as being taxpayer money, even though you could say, no, it's actually the parents' money because the parent was going to get taxed. That's not how it's going to appear to the general public. It's certainly not going to appear that way to the special interests, like the teachers, for example, the administrators. So they're going to demand, and you hear this every time, we can't have tax money, public money, going to unaccountable institutions. Well, the moment that prevails, and it always does prevail, that means then the government authority gets to set rules for so-called private schools. And even today, private schools are under a regulation. They have the power to regulate. The Supreme Court says they can do that. But the voucher will permit even more regulation. For example, in Wisconsin, when they started to let money go to religious schools, they said that, well, the Supreme Court said, well, you can go to a religious school as long as religion is not integral to the curriculum, and that the parents can opt their kids out of the religion classes. But there are some religious schools that it's religion is integrated through the whole curriculum. It's not a discrete class that a kid can just opt out of. And that, in a voucher system, that school will be not permitted to accept vouchers, which gives puts them at a competitive disadvantage. Some parents will say, well, I won't go to that school because they can't take the voucher. So there are going to be rules which will stifle educational innovation under a voucher system. So while I would say, you know, nice try, I would have to follow it up by saying no cigar. It doesn't really create a competitive market. It creates sort of an artificial market.
I can understand, though, even though I might not agree with them, why somebody might nevertheless say, since the Sheldon Richmond solution is unlikely to occur, this is a second best option. Would you be willing to accept vouchers as a second best option, or would you say it's just going so far in the wrong direction that I just want to think about the problem differently?
Yeah, I don't agree that it's a step in the right direction. I mean, someone will say to me, well, don't you approve of transition steps in the right direction? And if I thought it was in the right direction, I might say yes. The fact is, I don't think it's in the right direction. My old friend, the late Marshall Fritz, who was a great champion of separating school and state, I'd like to put it this way. The voucher is like attempting to bridge a 10-foot chasm with 2 5-foot planks. It just won't work. Right now we have, 88 or 90% of students on the government dole, namely the public schools, with about 10 not on the government dole. What the voucher plan presumes to do is to put 100% on the government dole as a way to getting to zero. And he wondered how the heck does that work? The other problem is the voucher movement is a rather disparate group of people. About half of them think the voucher will strengthen the public schools, and even Friedman argued this because of the competition. They don't want to lose children to private schools, so they'll get better. And the other half of the movement thinks it'll end up destroying the public schools, and actually think that's a good thing. In other words, the competition will be so great that nobody will be left in the public schools. Well, both can't be true, right? It can't both strengthen and destroy the public schools. There's something wrong.
Yeah, it's funny that it kind of reminds me of the way people, the protectionists, think about international trade, right? International trade is terrible for the rich countries, but then they turn around and say international trade exploits the poor countries. Somebody's got to be benefiting from international trade somewhere. All right. I want to ask you, though, I found it interesting in your book that in addition to raising the kinds of issues we would expect you to raise, like what would happen without these sorts of schools, what are the origins of these schools, you also attack the kind of schooling that traditionally goes on in a K-12 environment. Can you elaborate on that? Like, what's wrong with the actual approach that's being taken in the classroom from your point of view?
Well, it was an approach that was devised initially in Germany in the 19th century. And American social scientists and educators spent time in Germany, Bismarck's Germany in the later 19th century, and decided to bring that model here, although to some extent the model was already being pursued in the earliest days of public schools, which begins roughly around 1840 and then spreads through the states. It was a very regimented, authoritarian environment. If you think about it for a second, you're sitting, kids are sitting there, kids who are full of energy, want to move around, want to talk. They're ordered to sit still and be quiet for some period of time, and then when the bell rings, they're supposed to stop thinking about what they were thinking, math, let's say, and immediately turn to something else, geography. Even though they might be full of enthusiasm for math and want to keep talking about it, keep studying it, keep doing problems, but no, that's not the way it goes. The bell rings, and it's almost like Pavlovian, right? The bell rings, and then you switch. You turn your mind off to one subject and turn it on to another. It's a highly authoritarian system. Schools look like prisons. It's amazing when I drive around and see schools; they look like prisons to me. And it's an old-fashioned model that was based on based on the idea that schools were needed to train factory workers, civil servants, and soldiers. In other words, it was serving the state and also the state's allies in the world of big business that wanted to make sure there was a nice flow of quiescent workers and civil servants to work in the bureaucracies and soldiers. That's not what we need. Education should be about producing independent, thoughtful, innovative self-starters, and that's not what the schools are aimed at doing. People recognize this for a long, long time. John Stuart Mill understood it. H.L. Mencken understood it. If you go through the world of liberalism, that in the sense of libertarianism, you see this constant criticism of the government system that it's designed to produce conformity and things that we shouldn't be admiring.
And you have a chapter here called "Why There Are Public Schools." And I just want to read this one passage, couple sentences. Despite their differences, the thinkers discussed in this chapter shared at least one principle. They believed that the school should be the mechanism through which the state, run by the intellectual elite, would shape the youth of the nation. In a word, the school's business would be indoctrination. Now, this is not the usual version of things, right? The usual version is, education is a public good, and what's government for if not to provide public goods? But you and I and others take a more cynical view of what the state is up to here. When the state is giving us something for free, we want to look that gift horse in the mouth and say, what exactly is really going on here? Now, what do you think is going to be happening? I'm going to ask you to put your prognosticator hat on. And what do you think? Obviously, we can't anticipate what some entrepreneur is going to come up with. But obviously, we are living at a time when tremendous change is possible in education because of the technology that's available. And it could be possible now for more and more kids not to have to quit doing math because the bell rang and go on to the next regimented part of their day. And by the way, it would warm my heart if there were a lot of kids who felt so strongly about math that they wanted to keep doing problems. I almost was a math major, and that's really great even to think about that. But I mean, what do you think? Because it seems to me that both the technology and the falling prices, I mean, you can very cheaply educate somebody now with internet-based courses and stuff. Where do you think we're actually going?
Well, I hope it's going in that direction. There has been some, slow and steady increase in homeschooling, and a lot of that, I believe, is discovering the World Wide Web, and there are curricula and different approaches that you can now follow through the internet. So I hope it's hard to make a prediction. I hope it's going that way. And all I can say is we need to spread the word and talk about it and let people know, because most people don't spend time thinking philosophically about these things, and they kind of do things the way they learned it. I mean, most people went through public school, so they think, hey, I turned out okay, so it's okay for my kids. But inner city parents are wiser than I think other parents, because they see it. They're fully aware of the lousy situation their children are in. It's not only the teachers who may not care very much, which is not to say there are no teachers that care. There are many, but for the most part, that they view something to be desired. And plus, these schools are dangerous, and there's cops everywhere, and it's just a it's a stifling atmosphere, and I think people are looking for a better way, and they just need to see that this can be done outside of the traditional framework. And they need, we need to promote people like John Holt, who was a great philosopher of education, John Taylor Gatto. You can find his videos on YouTube talking about this. When Gatto and people like that talk, I mean, it's just so exciting what the possibilities are, that we don't need to put up with these dinosaur institutions any longer.
Now, Sheldon, of course, you write about many different topics, but if people wanted to follow your writing online, where would they find it?
Well, my primary writing is now occurring at the Future Freedom Foundation, which is fff.org. And I also have a blog called Free Association, which you can reach at sheldonrichmond.com.
Great. Well, Sheldon, I appreciate your time. I think we covered a lot of ground, and I hope people check out your book. Separating School and State is the title, How to Liberate America's Families. It's 1994, the publication date. Here we are at the end of 2013, but we still need to read and absorb this. And it's a quick read. It's enjoyable. You'll learn an awful lot. It's just the kind of book I really like. So, Sheldon, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, check out Sheldon Richman at SheldonRichman.com and FFF.org. Also, remember, 35% off subscriptions to my LibertyClassroom.com for all the Liberty lovers on your list this year. You can get this special offer, which is only for listeners of this program. Nobody else knows about it, by going to LibertyClassroom.com/secret. And as you finish up your shopping, don't forget, always, round the clock, 365 days a year, you can help us pay our bills at our little Tom Woods Show office at no cost to you, by going to TomWoodsRadio.com and entering Amazon from there, and then you can help us pay our bills here. All right, that's it for the program. See you all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.